From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. On this week's show, a check-in on NBAF, a controversial animal disease lab under construction in Kansas.
I just don't think it's the city commission's place to derail this at this point. It still may never get built in the long run, but that's going to depend on our Congress.
Plus, meet Stephanie Mott. She's a speaker and educator on transgender issues, and she'll share her journey with us.
You know, I got to be Stephanie in front of God and everybody, and it was okay, and it was beautiful, and it was amazing.
Plus, a local refugee from Sudan whose 8-year-old son has started a project to help the country.
Well, I just went to my room and got 10 pencils and ran downstairs and said, "Can I give these 10 pencils to the children of South Sudan?"
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We take you to neighborhoods around the region using voices, stories, and sound.
We start today with a story KCUR has been covering on an ongoing basis. The debate over the huge animal disease lab under construction, maybe, in Manhattan, Kansas. Experts say a release of the wildly contagious foot and mouth disease at the proposed National Bio and Agro Defense Facility, or NBAF, could cost the livestock industry millions, even billions, of dollars in damages. Laura Ziegler has been following the NBAF story and has this update on the lab's progress.
If you go look at the NBAF site, you're going to see a huge hole in the ground, much like the hole that's been there since ground was broken almost a year ago. But the Department of Homeland Security, which will operate the lab, actually just got title to the land this month. The city of Manhattan officially deeded over the 47-acre site, a move supporters hope will breathe new life into the beleaguered lab. Congress has frozen funding at $90 million amidst questions of security and necessity. With the fiscal cliff and budget talk distracting Congress, is NBAF a low priority? No, says Vice President for Research at Kansas State University, Ron Truen.
Recognizing all of these sorts of things, sequestration, fiscal cliff, all those things have the potential to create issues, but it's fairly clear there is a commitment by DHS to move forward.
Truen is referring to comments by DHS Secretary Janet Napolitano to Kansas Senator Jerry Moran in a Senate hearing in September. During those hearings, Secretary Napolitano told the senator that an NBAF-like lab was, in her words, critical to protect the U.S. from emerging and easily transferable pathogens. In answer to Moran's questions, Secretary Napolitano said DHS would partner with Kansas to get the Level 4 lab built in Manhattan. The secretary's statement came just a couple months after scientists with the National Research Council issued a report that raised significant questions about the lab. While the NRC report affirmed the necessity for a top security lab to protect the nation's food supply, it questioned the scale of the proposal. The scientists found that the proposed $1.1 billion lab might not need to be so huge and that it could well work in tandem with existing labs around the country. K-State's Dr. Truen says that is not going to happen.
Since that came out, where they had argued that perhaps a smaller facility would work, it's been pretty well confirmed that it would be higher cost trying to redesign than going forward with what's already designed.
But the controversy over the lab just seems to escalate. Opponents, ranchers, scientists, and residents of Manhattan continue their efforts to stop it. Gary Conrad is both a resident of Manhattan and a biologist at K-State. Speaking as a citizen, he said, and not on behalf of the university, he begged commissioners at the recent Manhattan City Commission hearing not to transfer the land to DHS. He said it was within their power to kill it.
The approval of NBAF went step by step. And if you gentlemen decide not to approve this step, that would stop it.
Some members of the commission said they shared Conrad's concerns about security at the lab, but believed the project was too far along for Manhattan to make a difference. Here's Commissioner Wynn Butler.
You know, you've got the federal government that says all the experts claim it will work in spite of my reservations and yours. And the state government seems to believe it, and that's why I say I just don't think it's the city commission's place to derail this at this point. It still may never get built in the long run, but that's going to depend on our Congress. I don't think we're going to settle that problem here.
The state of Kansas has made $150 million in bonds available to begin construction of a power plant on the site, but Congress hasn't been so forthcoming. Last year's funding was slashed from $150 to $50 million, and there is no new federal money in the pipeline right now. Kansas Senators Pat Roberts and Jerry Moran didn't return phone calls for this story. Congresswoman Lynn Jenkins, whose district would house the NBAF, emailed an upbeat but nonspecific statement saying the project will be in good shape once DHS has the land. Jenkins and other NBAF supporters point out there's another reason to believe NBAF will be built in Manhattan. They say studies going on right now at the Biosecurity Research Institute, a so-called Level 3 lab just adjacent to the NBAF site, will transfer to its Level 4 neighbor. The BRI was a major part of the incentive package Kansas offered DHS in trying to win NBAF. As controversy and budgets drag out the progress on the NBAF, the director of the BRI, Stephen Higgs, says it's possible NBAF won't be built.
It might not happen. My prediction is that it will. There's a great deal of support for it, and there's a great need for it.
Higgs also said research will continue at the BRI, whether NBAF comes online or not. Laura Ziegler, KCUR News.
Colleges and larger high schools often have co-ed cheer teams, but that's not the case with much smaller towns across America. As KSMU's Jennifer Davidson reports, one young man is bucking that trend.
This is a story about following your dreams, even though you might be swimming against the current. Colin Hadley, a senior at Koshkonong High School, that's in South Central Missouri, says he used to be shy and wasn't very social. One thing he loved to do was flips, as in
tumbling, back flips, front flips, side flips, wall flips.
He did these flips at a nearby gymnastics studio where his instructor said he should try cheerleading. There was only one problem. He wasn't aware of any male who had ever been a cheerleader in this tiny town. In small rural towns like this one, it's pretty unusual.
I never really wanted to do that because, you know, guys don't really cheerlead. I wasn't really comfortable with that.
But then he and a buddy were approached by a couple of high school girls at a baseball game. The girls wanted Hadley and his friend to be on a cheer team. That did the trick. He says he's endured a little bit of teasing from the guys, but he has credibility, he says, because of his gymnastic skills.
Like, if we're cheering for other schools, you know, obviously the community's kind of adjusted to it by now, but other schools aren't used to that, so we'll walk out there with the cheer team, and the other schools is kind of like, whoa, what is this? Is weird. Giving us looks and stuff, and then we start flipping around, and then it just all of a sudden the reactions are completely different. And they're like, wow, look at these guys. That's pretty awesome.
The tiny town of Koshkonong has a population of 212, and the high school is a stone's throw away from a cow pasture. Over the summer, Hadley left Koshkonong and drove to attend a three-day cheer camp. It was there, you could say, that he was discovered.
They just said, hey, you've been nominated as All-American, and you have the chance to try out.
Hadley did try out, and he made it as an All-American cheerleader. With that honor came the opportunity to go to London, if he could raise the money. With the support of his tiny community, he did. Even though he's never been on an airplane before, Colin Hadley will fly to England, where he'll perform in London's New Year's Eve parade and see the sights. I'm Jennifer Davidson.
Can't catch all of Casey Currents today? You can hear individual stories or the whole show online at kcur.org.
In late September, Kansas got an unofficial Facebook page with a tongue-in-cheek sense of humor and profanity in its name. The page is called F You, I'm from Kansas, and already it has garnered more than 23,000 likes on Facebook. KCUR's Maria Carter talked with the three-person team behind the page, Sarah Matthews, Jacqueline Grunau, and Will Averill, who explained why they started it.
When we first started, it was the theme behind the page was to celebrate sort of Kansas arts and culture, and to kind of get rid of this myth that I think is pervasive about the state, and that our, you know, sort of the only export culturally that we have is Westboro Baptist Church. And we really wanted to fight that. And The Wizard of Oz, of course. Not that those two are necessarily in the same category. So in the beginning, the posts were very much, I think, more tongue-in-cheek than they are today. You know, look, we got the world's biggest prairie dog. And, you know, and look here, it's Big Brutus, a huge steam shovel. And, you know, that was fun for a while. But then what we realized fairly early on is that, all these places that we were kind of tongue-in-cheek shouting out had a lot of meaning to people. So it's kind of been interesting. We also delved in on some posts about things that have been invented in Kansas, including the first prototype of the icy machine. The electric guitar was, if not invented, it was kind of popularized out of Wichita. Pizza Hut and White Castle.
I feel like no one really brags about being from Kansas. Part of it's just Midwestern modesty and just kind of maybe the overall perception of the state out in the wider world. And this sort of runs just like headlong into that.
And I think intentionally so. I think that there's a lot of Kansas pride.
The site itself is based on, I had lived in England for about 8 years, and I was shocked and horrified to find that Dorothy had, you know, gone before me, and that every time I would get this, you know, sort of oh, well, why are you going to the airport? Why not just click your heels together and get home? You know, and hearing about that, and then, you know, there's this one winter where it may have made the news over here. It snowed for about 4 hours, and Heathrow was closed down for about 4 days. I was like, well, you know, we may have Dorothy as one side of this state, but we also know how to handle ourselves in snow. And that sort of inspired a poem that was called F You, I'm from Kansas. It was, sort of a shot across the bow at this sort of pervasive stereotyping. That was sort of the basis for the website. I think that attitude, because it does get really frustrating, I think, to have that perception follow you everywhere, and especially knowing how many, you know, kind of great people have come out of the state of Kansas, how many great, sort of places there are, and that's sort of one of the main reasons we kind of started it up.
Do you have any delightful discoveries, people that you're like, wow, they're from Kansas, and that's awesome?
Yes, well, for me, one of the biggest, I would say, most kind of eye-opening, touching experiences has been from a lot of the military people who have posted or asked us to post photos from their hometown because they're missing their family and they're missing their home. And that, to me, was personally one of the most eye-opening moments, because, like Will was saying, you know, it started out as sort of an ironic, hey, we've got the biggest ball of twine, MFers, you know, or whatever. And then you realize that it's so meaningful to some people. And to me, that's when I was like, oh, you know, this is it's different than what we had anticipated, I think, from the beginning.
Are you ever worried that you're going to run out of things to post about Kansas?
I think that was sort of an initial worry, but at this point, no. Honestly, no. We have so many people that contribute to the site, and we have repeated a few things that we really like, or that people seem to really like. We'll repost those, but not because we don't have anything else to talk about. It's just we kind of want to make sure other people see it. But no, I don't think there's any fear of that at this point.
Well, and there's also always new things going on and new things to talk about. And there's so many wonderful small communities all across the state that have interesting stories, interesting histories here. And there's always somebody, it doesn't matter what post we put up. I put up this post one time of a picture I had taken near Natoma, Kansas, and it was just a silhouette of the landscape, and it was nighttime, and there were probably seven or eight people who were like, "That's Natoma," and it was crazy that they actually recognized it. And then they had stories about growing up there or visiting their grandparents.
That was Sarah Matthews, Jacqueline Grinnell, and Will Averill with the Facebook page FU I'm from Kansas. They spoke with KCUR's Maria Carter. Coming up, after being homeless and a battle with alcohol, Stephanie Mott found the support she needed to become a woman. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.
People who are transgender, meaning that they identify with a gender different from their biological one, face a difficult road to self-acceptance. They endure bullying and higher rates of discrimination in housing and in the job market. But less obvious is the psychological toll that being transgender takes.
According to the National Center for Transgender Equality, a startling 41% of transgender people in the United States have attempted suicide. This statistic is part of the reason why Stephanie Mott, executive director of the Kansas Statewide Transgender Education Project, is so involved in educating the public about transgender issues. She shared her own journey recently with Susan.
The very first thing I remember knowing about myself was that inside I was like my sisters, and outside I was like my brothers. I don't know that I felt like I was trapped in the wrong body or anything like that. It was just that this just wasn't who I was on the inside.
You were born Stephen Mott, am I correct?
Yes, that's the name that my parents gave to me.
So what was that like for you as a young child? How did it affect school or your relationships with parents and siblings?
Well, I learned at that same age, at 6 or 7 years old, to live my life inwardly. You know, where I couldn't, you know, let anybody know what was going on inside, and I couldn't talk about it, and I couldn't express myself as a girl. The exceptions to that would be, you know, I had two sisters when I was young, and I would borrow their clothes when I got the chance, but I would have to hide that. I was leading a double life by the time I was 6 or 7 years old.
Junior high and high school are times that can be very difficult for people in general. What was that like for you?
Well, I was blessed to be born into a loving home, and my mom was the basis for anything I know about unconditional love. And I was raised on a little farm outside of Eudora. It was a beautiful place to grow up. My dad was a good man. It was a great place to grow up. But at the same time, I was you know, not able to be who I was, and having to hide who I was, and understanding that there was something that people believed was wrong with people who were like me. And it seemed actually as though that it was more difficult as time went by. Every day it got more difficult.
What do you think made it more and more difficult?
You know, something about having to hide who you are that innately tells us that there must be something wrong with it. And so there was this concept of believing that there was something wrong with me. I can tell you that as a child, at 9, 10 years old, I spent hours sitting in the stairwell of our home looking through every volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica trying to find what was wrong with me. Hmm. Not something that described what was going on with me, but what was wrong with me. As I got older, I began to understand that the people who loved me, the people I loved, believed that people who were like me, they didn't know that I was transgender, but they believed, and I was aware of this, that they felt like that people like me were an abomination before God, and that was very difficult for me to deal with.
Now, did at any point when you were younger, did your mom or dad realize that something indeed was different, and did you ever talk to them about it?
This is the only thing I ever felt like I could not talk to my parents about. I talked to them about everything else that was going on in my life, but somehow I knew that this was something I couldn't talk to them about. And I think they knew that there was some kind of something going on, but they really didn't know what it was.
You entered KU, right, at around the age of 17 or so?
I did my first semester at KU. I was 17 years old. You know, I did fairly well. Life was much harder, like I said, as time went by and as I became older and understood that, you know, this was not something that was going to change. I was never going to, I thought, be able to live as a woman and then the fear that somebody would find out and shame of being something that God didn't approve of and those things. But still, there was a lot of other good things in my life which allowed me to do pretty well.
What were the good things?
Well, my family, you know, and my church, and there were, you know, I had some friends, not friends that knew anything about who I was on the inside, but people who at least accepted me as the very quiet person that I was.
Now, around this time, you discovered alcohol. What did alcohol do for you at that time?
Well, it allowed me not to have to feel the shame and not to have to feel the fear and not to have to feel the disconnect and not to have to feel the anger and just not have to deal with the reality that seemed so impossible. Just allowed me to escape from that.
What was that life that you imagined you'd have to live?
Well, I'd have to pretend to be somebody who wasn't me. I think the way I would tell about it is like entering into a play. And you enter into the play in the morning and you assume the part of this character that's been assigned to you. This character is assigned to you on the basis of your biological sex, but it's not really who you are. So you enter into the play in the morning and you play the part of this character, this boy that wasn't me and growing into a man that wasn't me. And you do it every day. And at night you come out of character and you dream for a little bit that maybe it'll be different someday. But then the next morning you wake up and you enter into the same play and it picks up where it left off the night before. And you do this day after day after week after month after year. And it just gets harder every day.
Now, at what point did you get married?
I got married the first time when I was 20 years old. I thought that was what I was supposed to do. I thought, you know, I have to live as a man. This is who I am. This is who I have to be. Even though I knew on the inside that's not who I was, that well, then if I'm going to be a man, I need to do things that men do. And thought maybe that would somehow help me find something. I don't know.
So how did it go?
We were together for about a year. That was at that same time when I was starting to drink very heavily as well. And we were divorced after about a year.
But you tried it again, right?
Well, I was still, I mean, I thought for a very long time that there was no possibility that I would ever be able to live as a woman, that I would have to live as a man, and I was just trying to be a man the way I understood what that was supposed to be like. I don't think you can build any kind of relationship on a lie, and my having to pretend to be a man, which is what I was doing, was a lie about who I was, and there was no real chance for me to be the person that I was supposed to be and to take part in life with joy and happiness. And I continued to drink and actually used this many, many years ago, but used drugs and in an attempt to try to hide from that reality still.
Things really took a bad turn. You lost your job. Of course, you were divorced. Tell us about that period.
Actually, in 2005, I became homeless, really not doing much of anything besides just being very much lost in my alcoholism and believing that eventually I would die and the pain would stop. And then at that point, when I became homeless, I asked my sisters, both of them, if I could move in with them in Lawrence, where they live now, and they both said no.
What did that feel like? To have sisters not help you in your time of need?
Well, I mean, my sisters and I have always, you know, loved each other dearly. And I think that they did that because that they loved me and that they knew that if they kept helping me, that I would never find a solution to my problems, whatever they were at the time. And I guess maybe it turns out that it was the most blessed thing that could have ever happened to me, because it was at that time that I made the decision to do what I needed to do to be able to live as a woman.
Tell me how, at that point, you conquered the alcoholism and got back on the path of trying to reconnect with who you really were.
Well, I ended up in Topeka at the rescue mission, the Topeka Rescue Mission, quite frankly, because I knew that they had a connection with Vallejo Behavioral Health Care, which has a drug and alcohol program, but also has therapists for other behavioral situations. And I thought maybe if I went to the rescue mission here in Topeka, that I would then be able to get into the drug and alcohol treatment program, and then hopefully eventually be able to see a therapist about my gender identity.
Well, you know, a lot of people go to alcohol treatment and doesn't always work the first time, but at this point you were really ready for change, right?
I really was. And, you know, some things fell into place for me, and I did get to go to Vallejo, to the drug and alcohol treatment program. And then a few months after that, I got to see a therapist about my gender identity and start trying to figure out exactly what I needed to do and how to do that. And then in July of 2006, I got invited to a church where the friend of mine who asked me to come to this church told me that there were other transgender people at the church. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe that, you know, there's actually transgender people in a church. And I had to go.
Now, when you met with the therapist, because I think there are a lot of people who might be struggling with that issue and they think, well, most therapists aren't even going to understand this very well. What did the therapist tell you at that time that was really helpful and healing?
Well, actually, she didn't know anything about transgender. I don't think she'd ever worked with a transgender patient before. But what she knew was how to make me comfortable talking about what I needed to talk about. And she was, you know, she just created an environment where I could talk to her and I could start sorting through the different things. And then we learned together about the different things that I needed to know.
It was in church, in fact, that you first showed up as Stephanie.
Yes, it was this at Metropolitan Community Church of Topeka. And well, I went the first time as Stephen. And I met this other transgender person, and it was the first time I'd ever known that I was talking to somebody who was transgender, and she looked like a woman, and I thought, oh my God, I can actually do this, I can actually transition. I went back to the church the next Sunday, and the pastor did a sermon on 2 Corinthians 5:17, which is, therefore, if anyone is in Christ, they are a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. And I was so sure that he was preaching at me and telling me it was okay with God, that I could transition, and that was okay with God. That was the first time I'd ever believed that at all. Then a couple weeks later, I went as Stephanie, and, you know, I was met with love, and, you know, the kind of love that Jesus talks about in the Bible, the I have some love, you look like you could use some love, here it is, no strings attached.
Yes.
And you know, I got to be Stephanie in front of God and everybody, and it was okay, and it was beautiful, and it was amazing. And I sat down in the sanctuary, and I looked up at the cross, and I felt truth and self in the eyes of the Lord for the first time. And Stephanie was born. And I just haven't looked back since then. It's just that knowledge that it was okay to be who I was, and that I could do that, and that there were people that would help me. It just changed everything. Not long after that, one of the people from the church asked me to go speak at a high school gay straight alliance and tell my story. And I went and I spoke, and I was very nervous, and I spoke for about 5 minutes, and I thought I did a horrible job. But when I got done, one of the students came up to me, and a young transgender teenager, and said to me that I had changed her life. And I was thinking to myself, you have no idea, but you just got through changing my life as well.
I want to talk to you about one of your experiences with the healthcare system, because studies show that transgender people face a lot of health disparities within the healthcare system. Can you talk a little bit about your experience?
Transgender people do experience great healthcare disparity. A study that was done in 2011 and by the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and the National Center for Transgender Equality showed that 28% of transgender people have been turned away for just plain basic medical health care. As in, I'm a sick doctor, will you help me? And the doctor says, no, I won't, you're transgender. and not transgender-related health care, but basic health care. But after I started my transition and was taking hormones, I began to have breast development, and learning about the journey, I discovered that it was necessary for me to have a mammogram after about the second year on hormones. I went to have my mammogram very, very afraid of how I was going to be responded to, and whether or not that, you know, I was going to be embarrassed or what, or, you know, I was 50 years old when I started my transition, and so my breasts are not typical, probably quite, but they're still, you know, I'm very pleased with that, but I was afraid of how I would be received. Turns out that I was received very well. The technician was very kind, and we talked a little bit about the health disparities, and she made me very, very comfortable. But at the same time I was experiencing this fear, I was also experiencing this joy that I was getting to do this very much woman thing of having a mammogram. And so the whole experience was just fantastic, and especially with the way that I was treated by the technician. She did a great job, although I know of a number of friends who, I have a friend who when they decided to transition, that their doctor fired them, said that they wouldn't see them anymore because they were transgender.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, have you completely transitioned at this point?
I was able to have my surgery in May of this year in Bangkok, Thailand. And so, yeah.
Huh. Why Bangkok?
Because it was $10,000 instead of $20,000.
That's a good answer.
Yeah. You know, I would much prefer to be able to have it in the United States, but it's just not covered by health care. My health insurance policy has an exclusion in it that says that they won't pay for anything related to a sex change, including complications from a sex change surgery. So if I had problems, those would not be covered by insurance either.
And I trust that your experience, your healing process went well.
It's good, yes.
That's very good.
Yeah. There's something a little bit different, too, that's changed with the Affordable Health Care Act that is commonly known as Obamacare. The Health and Human Services has said that gender identity is covered under the umbrella of sex when it comes to the anti-discrimination clause in the Affordable Health Care Act. And it doesn't mean that the insurance has to pay for transgender-related medical care, but it does mean that doctors can't any longer legally turn away a transgender person for just basic health care.
So let's turn to your life's work right now. Because of what you went through, you've made it your life's work to really educate the public and assist other people going through the transgender journey along the way. So tell me about the organization that you're executive director of, and you founded that organization, didn't you?
Yes. I realized that if I wanted to be able to speak at a wider audience about what it's like to be transgender, that I would need to have more credibility. And so I reached out to some people that I knew across the state of Kansas and said, let's all meet in Salina, Kansas, and at the library and talk about whether or not we want to create a statewide organization. And we had people from pretty much across the state that showed up for that first meeting in August of 2010. And then we decided that we would make this organization. We would incorporate as Kansas Statewide Transgender Education Project, which we also call K-STEP. We decided that our mission would be to end discrimination against transgender people and their families in Kansas through education. And we've since then done more than 200 educational presentations, interviews, and interventions and different things across the state.
Now, as far as questions you get or reactions you get, any surprises or things that stand out as you've been doing this education?
Well, the most common misunderstanding that people have is that the transgender is somehow the same thing as gay. And of course it's not. And generally speaking, people are like, that's gay, right? When they find out that I'm transgender, and I'm like, no, sexual orientation is about who you love, and gender identity is about how you identify with male or female, who you are. And that's the most common thing. One of the things that happens from time to time is that I'll have somebody ask me, how do I reconcile my faith with the fact that I'm transgender? And there's a concept somehow that I believe that God made a mistake, and that by living as a woman that I'm correcting that mistake. And I don't believe that. I believe that God created me exactly the way that God intended to create me. And that there are a lot of things that God does that I don't understand why they're that way. Some of them very beautiful, and some of them very, very difficult to understand. But I don't know why God does so many different things, and I don't know why God made me transgender. But I think it's really important for people to have the right to believe that there's something wrong with me, if that's what they want to believe. And what I try to do when I do an educational program is not really about trying to change their mind about how they feel about who I am, but it's more about trying to expose my humanity. And I think the better job I do of exposing my humanity, the more difficult it is for someone to justify discrimination.
Topeka's Stephanie Mott is the executive director of the Kansas Statewide Transgender Education Project. She speaks nationally on transgender issues and is a columnist for Liberty Press. If you missed part of Casey Currents today, you can catch individual stories or hear the whole show online at kcur.org. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
Coming up, the son of an area Sudanese lost boy takes his first trip to Sudan. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Hay, one of ranching's most basic materials, is in high demand right now, and hay theft is on the rise. The summer's drought has decreased the supply of hay across much of the U.S. It's resulting in higher prices and hay banditry. Reporting for Harvest Public Media, here's the story from Grace Hood in Colorado.
Before this year, rancher Ted Swanson had only been the victim of theft once in his life.
I had a bicycle stolen in Chicago about many years ago. That was about it.
Fast forward to Labor Day weekend. That's when Swanson noticed about $5,000 worth of hay missing from his northern Colorado ranch. It had been sitting in his field near the side of the road.
They stole some 4x4x8s, some 3x4x8s, and some big round bales.
About enough hay to fill a semi-truck. Swanson suspects someone stole the hay to sell and make a profit. The job sounds very labor-intensive until you learn that thieves hot-wired Swanson's front-loader tractor to do the heavy lifting.
Apparently left it idling because it was completely out of fuel when we discovered everything. So
you must have been shocked.
Very much, yes.
Colorado isn't the only place hay has been stolen. Farmers in California, Missouri, Nebraska, and Oklahoma have also been the victims of theft. Hay is especially valuable during the winter months when dairy farmers and ranchers typically can't use snow-covered pastures for grazing their livestock. But this summer's drought decreased supply across the country, causing a crunch for everyone.
Hay is a hot commodity right now.
Tess Norville tracks hay prices for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Colorado, one of the places where hay is most expensive. Here, ranchers are actually seeing a shortage for the second year in a row. Back in 2011, Colorado hay started flowing into Texas because that state was in a drought.
We've been trying to pull hay in from other regions, but since other regions or other states are just as dry as we are, it's just pretty dire situation.
Norville says it's the worst right now for smaller outfits that can't buy huge quantities in bulk, like Windsor Dairy. Under the watchful eye of owner Arden Nelson, about a dozen calves eat green alfalfa for lunch.
It's caviar of the hay world, no doubt about it.
Nelson was willing to pay $300 a ton for this premium hay because it's the most nutritious for his growing calves. Here, theft isn't a worry. It's finding enough feed for this 100-cow operation to make it through the winter. After considering shipping in hay from Montana and Nevada, Nelson settled on purchasing truckloads from a neighbor.
Doesn't mean we have enough, but we have good hay for this year. It just costs a lot more.
More than twice what it's cost in previous years for this grass-fed operation. Some of those costs are passed along to Nelson's customers who participate in a raw milk share program. This year, he's instituted a hay surcharge for members.
And we've had people pay that willingly and then actually donate money to us on top of that, which makes you feel really, really good.
Back on Ted Swanson's ranch, a front loader tractor moves around large bales in the afternoon sun. While police didn't have enough evidence to track down the culprit in his hay theft case, he did make some changes.
Put locks on all the gates. Chains and padlocks.
But he acknowledges that's not going to stop someone desperate enough to steal.
If somebody were really determined, I don't suppose it would stop them, but at least maybe slow them down enough.
Because hay bales look so similar, it's hard to catch thieves, but not impossible. Earlier this month, an Oklahoma farmer tracked down some stolen hay with the help of a GPS tracker hidden in one of the bales. With so much money at stake, fewer farmers are willing to leave anything to chance. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Grace Hood.
That report was from Grace Hood, a reporter for KUMC in Greeley, Colorado, the newest station to join the Harvest Public Media Network. Learn more about Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of public media stations across the Midwest, and hear more stories at harvestpublicmedia.org.
In recent years, urban planners have renewed their focus on creating walkable communities. Walking is the most basic mode of transportation, and yet in the Kansas City metropolitan area, it's not as common as in other parts of the country. KCUR's Laura Spencer has this report of one man who walks the roads less traveled across Kansas.
The Kansas City Public Library hosts hundreds of events each year, and often a familiar face, a man with glasses and a full beard, provides introductions, but not on this night in early October.
Good evening. My name is Stephen Wolfolk. I'm the Assistant Director of Public Affairs here at the Kansas City Public Library, and I have the honor of introducing tonight's program because my boss, Henry Fortunato, who I'm sure many of you know, is off on one of his famous walkabouts. He is actually traveling by foot as we speak from Johnson County to Wichita, Kansas.
That's roughly 200 miles, or a little over 3 hours by car, but by foot.
I walked out my front door in Overland Park, and 13 days later, I was in downtown Wichita.
Henry Fortunato, Public Affairs Director of the Kansas City Public Library, says there's lots of planning that goes into his walkabouts. He's done about 10 of them now. Usually they're 4 or 5 day walks, but this one at 13 days was the longest. He uses Google Maps extensively, magnifying possible routes along gravel, dirt, or slightly paved roads and trails.
There is tremendous satisfaction in self-locomotion over long distances. It's an achievement. It's not like scaling the Matterhorn, but it certainly makes me feel like at my age, and I'm 56, that I'm still in reasonably good shape and I can make things happen.
Fortunato does not drive and hasn't since at least the late 1970s. He moved to Kansas in 1997, but he grew up on the East Coast, living in New York and then Washington, D.C. So public transportation and walking have always been a part of his daily life.
For me, walking is a marvelous and restorative experience. I get to think about things. I get to solve whatever challenge is facing me at the time. And it's really good exercise. You know, you're walking 3, maybe if you're walking really fast, 3.5, 4 miles an hour. But that's a really nice pace. You can really see a lot of things. You can see the changes in the land. You can see the changes in a neighborhood. You can study things up close. And I think it leads to a more fulfilling experience.
But walking across Kansas? Here's how Fortunato puts it. At first, he was an accidental Kansan. Now he embraces his role as, what his family calls, a naturalized Kansan. He and his wife took their children on yearly trips to explore the state. And walking, he says, allows him to appreciate its subtle beauty.
To me, walking through, let's say, the Tallgrass Prairie Preserve or the Kansas Prairie just south of Manhattan. You know, those trails go through the prairie, and when you're walking it, you see the gradations. You see that there's a dozen or so different shades of yellow and green and brown and gray and bits of red and bits of purple. And the landscape, people think it's flat and boring and unchanging, but in fact, it changes every quarter mile one way or the other.
Fortunato earned his master's in history from the University of Kansas with a focus on Kansas and the Midwest. He says it's hard sometimes walking past abandoned buildings and small towns not to think of history in a melancholy way. But then he says there are those places that have found a way to embrace the current age and survive.
One of the best things for me was in a place called Marion, Kansas, where the old Santa Fe Railroad Station has been transformed into a glorious public library, and that was great to see.
Fortunato hopes to collect his stories and photos in a book, and that's still a work in progress. Laura Spencer, KCUR News.
To see some pictures of Henry Fortunato on the road, check out our website at kcur.org. In 2001, when the Lost Boys of Sudan came to the United States, most of the young refugees brought painful memories of war, as well as a deep desire to help their home country. Now, over a decade later, many of them have families and children of their own. A former Lost Boy living in Kansas City recently found out that his devotion to Sudan doesn't end with him. John Akui was as surprised as anyone else when his 6-year-old son decided he wanted to collect school supplies for children in South Sudan. Alex Smith has the story.
For years, John Akui and Rebecca Mabier followed the news and searched the internet to find out the latest from their home country of Sudan. The couple is part of the Dinka ethnic group, and they had each fled for their lives from Sudan when the government tried to wipe out the Dinkas during the country's second civil war. John and Rebecca often spoke with fellow refugees about signs of hope in Sudan or ways to help the struggling country, but they were reluctant to discuss the painful, complicated subject with their 3 young American-born children. That changed in spring of 2011 when the family was watching scenes of poor rural life in South Sudan on the internet. For the first time, their son Atim, who's now 8, spoke up and asked his parents about the children on the screen. John Akui explains.
You know, one day when we were watching the news about the children in South Sudan that were walking with a bad food, they don't have shoes and they don't, you know, they wear shorts, they don't have clothes, and then the school under the, you know, under the tree where the children ride in the dirt with their finger. So Atim saw that and he just jumped to his mom and said, "Hey, mommy, what is this? Why these children are crying and why they ride with their finger in the dirt?"
John grew up in rural southern Sudan in the early 80s. The area received almost no funding for schools or infrastructure from the national government in the north because of ethnic conflict between the two regions. Like the children in the video, John Akui was taught math and writing by drawing in the dirt with his fingers. It's a practice that continues to this day. When Atim found out about it, he decided he wanted to help.
Well, I just went to my room and got 10 pencils and ran downstairs and said, "Can I give these 10 pencils to the children of South Sudan?"
Growing up in southern Sudan, John and his family struggled with poverty and lack of opportunity, but these trials couldn't prepare him for what came next. In 1983, when John was 4 years old, the Sudanese government started attacking southern towns to stop the emergence of the Sudan People's Liberation Army, which was started to stand up for the people of southern Sudan. The Sudanese military targeted young boys to prevent them from joining the SPLA. In 1987, on the night the army came to John's village, he and the other boys ran to escape being killed. They ran all night and hid out during the day for the next 30 days, eventually traveling 1,000 miles through the brush to refuge in Ethiopia. John Akui still has scars around his ankles from running during this month-long exodus.
Those scratches happened when I hit the wood with my leg when I was running. And I feel the pain, but, you know, because of fear, I wasn't really focusing on pain. I was focusing on how to get away.
John eventually settled in a refugee camp in Kenya, where he lived for 9 years. In 2001, John and about 3,800 other Lost Boys of Sudan were allowed to resettle in the United States. John took a job at a paper company in Kansas City and joined a growing community of Sudanese expatriates here. And at a Sudanese community get-together, he met Rebecca Mabier.
The first time I saw her, it was so amazing, and I was just saying, "Oh, you know, I'm lucky. I saw a girl here that came from Sudan, and, you know, she looked like us, and I would maybe see if we can, you know, get together sometime."
Rebecca, like John, is slender and well over 6 feet tall. Though she grew up in the north of Sudan, Rebecca is also Dinka. John says it's important to the Lost Boys to find Sudanese wives and start Sudanese families.
We feel like if we marry from our own community, then we will keep the same story together, and then we will think about the people back home together. So this will keep us strong, and we are not going to lose our history. So we will keep our history to the generation to come.
Rebecca and John were married in 2003, and Atim was born a year after that. They later had twins, a boy and a girl named Akui and Akon. Although the couple was committed to helping Sudan, they hadn't discussed it with their children. John says he was surprised when Atim first suggested collecting pencils.
First of all, my reaction, I wasn't prepared enough. even to tell people about my hometown. So my son took over and tell me what I supposed to do. So I feel guilty. You know, when Atem was starting that, I was really feel guilty. Even the water started to drop in my eyes because I say, Atem, how did Atem just saw something in the internet and begin to ask me and my wife that we could deliver only 10 pencils? And we are the one who bought that 10 pencils. I didn't even thought about giving 10 pencils to children in South Sudan. So I feel guilty at that time, and I don't want to let it go because it was a chance for me. You know, he was just reminding me on what we're supposed to do.
Atem and his parents started talking to friends, classmates, co-workers, and church congregants about Sudan and asked their help with collecting pencils and other school supplies. The drive was more successful than any of them could have imagined. They've collected nearly 38,000 pencils and other school supplies as well. And now that Atem has been asking about Sudan, John and Rebecca have been more open to talking about it, though they're still reluctant to tell him the details of the war.
Well, the thing that I want Atem, you know, to know, Atem, at least, he want to know where I came from. That will let him understand, you know, why am I here? So I tell Atem that, Atem, we are belong to South Sudan. I came from far away, and we came here because somebody, you know, the government didn't like us because of our differences, our religious. And I did not talk much about what was the big impact, what is really affecting us, but I was just... Because Atem is still 8 years old, he need to know some of my background, but he don't need to know everything because his mind is still devolving.
The Second Sudanese Civil War ended in 2005, and in July of 2012, South Sudan became an independent country. John and Rebecca decided they wanted Atem to see the new country, so on Christmas Day, Atem and his mother will go there to see relatives and deliver some pencils. John explains why it's important for Atem to see South Sudan.
Atem need to go there and see with his own eyes. And then I want Atem to go and sit under the tree with them also and see how it feel like to sit under the tree and ride in the dirt. I want Atem also to know that these are, you know, his brothers and sisters who are suffering there. Not only people that he's helping them. His blood. And he want to feel it also. By sitting down there, how do you feel like? And when he come back here, I think Atem will always be focusing, you know, on how we can help those people back home. And also, I need also those people who are back home to feel like we are not forgetting about them. We never forget about them. We are still with them, and we will be always with them.
8-year-old Atem Akwi is already planning a bigger project to help South Sudan. He's raising money to build a school there. John and Rebecca are working with their church, Gashland United Methodist in Gladstone, on a project called Journey of Hope. Their goal is to provide clean drinking water to rural South Sudan. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
We'll close this show with a favorite seasonal song. This is John Akui singing the hymn Onward Christian Soldiers as it's sung in Sudan in the Dinka language. Well, we thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Suzanne Hogan and Alex Smith. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Zach Lewandowski is our awesome intern, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson, and at KC Currents, we want to wish you and your family a very happy holiday season and a prosperous and healthy new year.